And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy!
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds!
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to another episode of And Colossally, That's History, the podcast where we reappraise motor racing history. I'm Matt Bishop and I'm joined as ever by Richard Williams for what is excitingly the first episode of a multi-part mini-series.
Yes, that's right, Matt, because as many of you may know, 2024 marks the 30th anniversary of one of motor racing's blackest weekends, the 1994 San Marino Grand Prix, when both Ayrton Senna and Roland Ratzenberger were killed in action. We believe this topic is just far too big and far too important to tackle in one podcast, so we're going to try to do it justice over three.
That's right. Not one, not two, but three. So on the next episode, we're going to dive into events of the Imola weekend itself in detail. But on this, the first of our three episodes, we're going to look at events leading up to the 1994 San Marino Grand Prix. And I don't just mean immediately preceding that weekend. I also mean how Formula One evolved to get to the point where something like this could even happen. Now, Richard, you wrote an excellent book, which I'm sure many of our listeners own. And by the way, if they don't, they should. And it's called The Death of Ayrton Senna. So I'm assuming that your knowledge on the topic is second to none, and I'll just be able to sit quiet for the next hour.
Well, not exactly. Nobody has ownership of a definitive account of these things. I did spend and have spent a great deal of time thinking about it and writing about it. I wrote about Senna quite a lot during his lifetime and his career because, of course, he was an exceptionally interesting racing driver, particularly for journalists like me. But then when he died, it was such a big thing. It was the first, that weekend with Ratzenberger and Senna was the first really big shock that Formula One had had for a long time. And to lose such a champion was horrifying. And I began thinking about writing a book based on that. And immediately after the race, I went to São Paulo for the funeral, which was an extraordinary event I'll talk about later. And then 3 years later, I went to, because the inquiry into this terrible accident lasted a very long time. And it was 3 years later that I went to the inquest in Imola to hear some people, including Damon Hill, who was Senna's teammate, give evidence in the attempt to discover what had caused the tragedy.
So those are some of the themes that we will be covering in the next hour. But let's now begin to set the scene for the 1994 San Marino Grand Prix by looking at the lay of the land, if I can call it that, of Formula One itself in the early 1990s, starting with the cars. So looking back now, we may think that the cars of the early 1990s look horribly unsafe by today's standards. You know, the drivers' heads and shoulders even are exposed and so on. But it's easy to forget that at the time, they really were the safest Formula One cars that we'd ever seen, that had ever raced. And they were regarded as paragons of safety, weren't they?
They were. And as we'll talk about later, people did at that time get out of horrifying shunts relatively unscathed.
They did. And there were reasons why. For example, every car on the grid in 1994 would have had a carbon fiber monocoque. And that was a truly remarkable development when it was first introduced by McLaren in 1981. We probably all remember John Watson's enormous shunt in that McLaren at the second Lesmo at Monza in 1981. And that was important, seminal, really, because his McLaren had a carbon fibre chassis. And as a result, he hopped out of a shunt that, you know, a huge shunt, a shunt that might well have killed him had his car had an old type pre-carbon fiber chassis, but it didn't. Thankfully, it had a carbon fiber one. And I want to say something about John Watson here. John Watson survived that huge Monza shunt in 1981. Then the next year, he and Derek Warwick pulled Gilles Villeneuve as he breathed his last out of the catch fencing where his dying body had been hurled out of his wrecked Ferrari at Zolder. Despite, this is an important point, despite Watson not being a Villeneuve fan by his own admission, and indeed despite Watson having been pretty outspoken in his criticisms of Villeneuve and René Arnoux after their famous and brilliant but indisciplined wheel-banging dice at Dijon in 1979. And then what happened next? John Watson won the race at Zolder the day after Gilles had been killed there. And what he won brilliantly. So an underrated Formula One star is our Watty, in my opinion. I once asked him about that race, Zolder 1982, and he just shrugged and said, someone had to win the damn thing. Anyway, I think that says a lot about the attitude and the grim courage of drivers who had grown up with the danger of death as an ever-present spectre, as indeed John Watson, who of course made his Formula One debut in the early 70s, or the mid-70s, and then raced through that period to the 80s, as John Watson had.
Yes, drivers grew up wanting to do this thing, wanting to drive an F1 car, knowing the dangers that came with it and knowing the historical precedents. In the 50s, you were driving basically with a fuel tank around you and not much in the way of a chassis to protect you. Then aluminium space frames came along, and if you shunted one of those, it just kind of crumpled around you like matchsticks.
Yeah.
Then we had aluminium monocoques, which had a certain amount of greater integrity, and then carbon fiber monocoques had a lot more. They were a lot stronger in every direction.
Big change.
Yeah, yeah, as well as being stiffer and better for performance as well. But by the early 90s, while you have a grid full of carbon fiber chassis, you also have cars that have lots of sophisticated electronic controls and driver aids, such as traction control and active suspension, all of which allowed the cars to go faster than ever before. So on the one hand, you've got much stronger cars that can withstand more force and protect the driver better. But on the other hand, you've got drivers cornering and crashing at higher speeds.
Yeah.
And really, it's the cornering speeds that are crucial here. Grand Prix cars were doing 200 miles an hour before the Second World War in a straight line, but they weren't going around corners very fast. That's where speed evolution has come in and where the danger has resided as the cars have got safer.
Well, you say safer, and I know why you say that. But in road cars, we talk about active safety and passive safety. Passive safety meaning seatbelts, airbags, crumple zones, all those things. In other words, the things that help you survive in the event of an accident, in other words, after an accident has happened. But active safety is the stuff that stops you having an accident in the first place. Better grip, better steering, better brakes, etc. And as you rightly say, Richard, as the 1970s rolled into the 1980s, you begin to have cars that are perhaps safer in the passive sense, but they're also faster, especially in the corners, as you say. And at the same time, while circuits in the early 1990s were also probably a bit safer than they'd ever been or been in the past, they weren't anything like as safe as they are now. And again, we might look back now and think that some elements of the circuits were then horribly unsafe. But massive steps had actually been made to make them safer, if not safe. than they were in the 80s or before. I mean, we weren't racing at the old Spa, the old Nürburgring, or Clermont-Ferrand, or Rouen, places like that, were we?
No, you wouldn't go off into a cornfield anymore.
Exactly.
Or hit a row of pine trees or a telegraph pole. You wouldn't end up upside down in a ditch, as people sometimes did. That changed as a result of the safety campaign largely led by Jackie Stewart at the end of the 1960s and the beginning of the 70s, when he'd basically got fed up of seeing his friends, his really close personal friends, like Jim Clark and Jochen Rindt and François Sauveur, being killed. He and his wife, Helen, had got sick of going to those funerals and wanted to do something about it.
But it didn't make him popular with purists, did it, Richard?
No, it didn't. Some people with loud voices felt that it was damaging the sport, damaging its traditions. As these various changes were made in response to what Jackie was saying, you know, Armco barriers were made standard. They got rid of straw bales after Lorenzo Bandini had been burnt to death at Monaco in 1967. And corners, some of them very famous corners, were eased to make them less dangerous and so on. But, you know, among the people who were against all that was Dennis Jenkinson, the famous continental correspondent of motorsport, who went to all the Grand Prix in the 1950s and 1960s and was read avidly by many of us, you know, who took his word as gospel.
Totally.
And he was pretty scornful about what Jackie was doing. And of course, to anyone who said, oh, he's just a journalist, what's he done that's dangerous? He was the passenger in the motorcycle sidecar world championship combination with Eric Oliver in 1949.
Amazing, those photographs of Jenks DSJ with Eric Oliver.
Yeah, hanging out, hanging off a sidecar, going around Spa.
Amazing. The vernacular that it requires is... big balls, I think, is the phrase, is it not?
What they say.
Yeah. I believe it is. Jenks was also, let's not forget, he was the navigator for Stirling Moss in the Mille Miglia in 55, was he not?
Yes, that a mad race around the roads of Italy.
I know, averaging 100 miles an hour?
Yeah, averaging 100 miles an hour around the country. No autostrada in those days.
Yes.
Just sort of semi-closed roads with people at the... at the roadside, and you know, you've got to be brave to sit next to Moss in that race for sure. But he was very strong on the fact that he believed that in motor racing there should always be the challenge of mortal risk.
And so was Stirling. You know, he died 4 years ago, but really, up till quite recently, he was saying quite. Well, I was going to say brazenly, but quite openly, saying that the fear of something going wrong. I don't mean he didn't talk about the appeal of the danger of death. I don't think we could accuse him of saying that. But he did say that the fear of something going wrong was part of the motivation of a top driver, a really top driver, to show that he was made of sterner stuff than his rivals.
Yes. You know, you could divide the drivers of those... years into two, between drivers who loved road circuits, loved the open road racing with natural hazards, and those who preferred to race on airfields, where, you know, which were relatively safe, controlled environments. And Dennis Jenkinson certainly thought that what Jackie Stewart was doing was emasculating the sport.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, probably a lot of people who didn't die and their families would have thanked Jackie for what he'd done.
Undoubtedly.
And there were other things too, the creation of the Grand Prix Medical Unit, which I think Lewis Stanley, the controversial boss of BRM, a much maligned character, had a lot to do with. He was maybe the first person to realise that there ought to be special facilities rather than just relying on the St. John's ambulance service in some, you know, slightly broken down old ambulance. There should be bespoke facilities. And then Bernie Eccleston brought in Sid Watkins, the eminent neurosurgeon, to be F1's resident doctor, which was a very important step.
Very important. And you mention ambulances, but that was if an ambulance could be found. Sometimes injured drivers were taken by car, just a car that happened to be hanging around, and a normal driver, not an ambulance driver, taken by car to the local hospital. And sometimes the person driving didn't really know the way.
No.
It was absolutely chaotic. And they drove, the, you know, drivers sometimes, you know, racing drivers sometimes died in those cars.
Yeah.
Normal passenger cars with a normal driver trying to find his way to the hospital. Terrible, really.
And if they did get there, if they did get to the hospital would not have been prepared.
Yes.
They wouldn't have had a trauma unit specially waiting ready for such casualties as they do now.
Might not even know that the racing driver was on his way.
No, indeed not.
Yeah.
And test sessions were, you know, potentially particularly lethal because there were no facilities at all. Nobody bothered to arrange anything. So if you had your big shunt in testing, as Elio De Angelis did at Paul Ricard in 1986, you were in big trouble. But anyway, by the 90s, quite a lot of that had been improved out of all recognition from what we think of as the classic periods of Formula One racing, the period when people were killed virtually every other weekend. But the circuits still weren't exactly what you'd call safe. There were still major dangers at a lot of the circuits, short or almost non-existent runoff areas and concrete barriers at oblique angles and that sort of thing. And Tamburello, the flat-out left-hander that opened the lap at Imola, where the San Marino Grand Prix took place in 1994, that stood out as a very unsafe corner, you'd have to say.
Yeah, you would indeed. I sometimes think it's a little bit like when people have been say people have been campaigning to put a zebra crossing on a particularly unsafe bit of public road, and nothing really happens, and the campaigners carry on, and then it finally needs a tragedy to take place before the zebra crossing finally is put in.
Exactly.
And I think perhaps Tamburello was like that, or a bit like that, because it was obviously dangerous. It had become plain that it was dangerous. It was a very fast left-hander, as you say, Richard, but the runoff was visibly, perilously too little. And obviously we now know, with hindsight, what happened in 1994, and we'll come to that in our next episode, as I say, but it was already, Tamburello was already, as the saying goes, an accident waiting to happen.
Yeah, and nothing could be done about it without making a major change. It wasn't a case of just putting in another barrier as it might have been at other corners, at other circuits. You couldn't move the barrier back because there's a river there.
Yeah, exactly.
The Santerno. It's the river that flows through Imola, and it's a very nice river, and you wouldn't want to move it even if you could, which you can't.
Yeah.
One of the reasons I always loved Imola was that if you were staying in the centre, you just walked across a bridge over the Santerno and you were in the circuit. It's local. It's really local. And the river is part of the beauty of the circuit.
I mean, isn't it a beautiful circuit and a beautiful place to visit?
Oh, everything about it. I mean, you know, the ups and downs, the hills, the trees, the houses on the infield, vineyards, all kinds of things.
I used to stay in Riolo Terme.
Yep.
Beautiful little place.
Yep. Driving over the hills. Early in the morning to get to the circuit.
Misty.
Yeah.
Yes.
Through beautiful. The vineyards. Gorgeous.
Yes. Yes.
Anyway, but then, of course, Tamburello. The outside of the left-hander was right up against the river, so no way you could even make one of those nice runoff areas. You have a place like Paul Ricard now, where the drivers know they can go off as far as they want to go off and come back in one piece.
Or Bahrain. And places like that. When Bahrain, which was obviously the first of the circuits, Formula One circuits in that part of the world, I used to say the runoff was basically a desert. You know, you've got a desert to run off into. But yes, Tamburello, very different from that. And it did even then stand out as dangerous, perhaps Formula One's most dangerous corner at the time. And we'll talk more about that in part two.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. you can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
We finished part one by talking about Tamburello at Imola, and we'll come back to that in a moment. But I'd like to kick off part two, if I may, with some stats. And I'm afraid they're rather grim stats, but I use them to illustrate a point. If we look at driver deaths from crashes in the Formula One World Championship Grand Prix, not tests or non-championship races, but Formula One World Championship Grand Prix, we had four in the 1950s. Then we moved up to eight in the 1960s. Interesting that the 1960s was more dangerous in terms of body count, if I can call it, than
there
the
were, 1950s. Of course, more races.
There were more races.
The number of races was going up all the time.
They were indeed. And then eight again in the 1970s, the number of races going up again as well. But then, although the number of races was still either maintaining or increasing after the 70s, only two in the 1980s. So altogether we had four in the 50s, eight in the 60s, eight again in the 70s, and two in the 80s. And of course, both those deaths were in the very early 80s, both of them in 1982, in fact. So I'm going to ask you a question, Richard. Do you think there was a sense that by the early 1990s, which was, you know, 1990 was 8 years after we'd had a death in a Formula One Grand Prix meeting. Do you think that Formula One had become complacent about safety because of the lack of deaths, or were things simply as safe as they could be?
I think there was a degree of complacency, and it was understandable. To reach the 90s with 8 years between fatal driver accidents at a race meeting, that's quite a long time in Formula One terms.
Yeah.
Certainly compared, as you've been saying, to the frequency in the deaths in the decades beforehand. And it's sort of understandable that people might have been thinking, oh, well, things are all right, yeah, really now. Those two accidents in 1982 were absolutely shocking, of course. Nothing more shocking than losing a hero like Gilles Villeneuve in practice at Zolder. A terrible, terrible accident which came on the heels of a controversial race at Imola, where he and his Ferrari teammate, Didier Pironi, had disagreed over who should win the race. Villeneuve thought they had an agreement, but Pironi snatched the win and Villeneuve felt betrayed. He went into the next race at Zolder feeling exactly that. And, you know, there was a question of whether the balance of his mind had impacted him, whether that had something to do with the accident. But actually, if you look at it, it was just a racing accident, albeit a particularly horrible one.
Horrible, terrible, yes. And one that Jochen Maas, poor Jochen Maas, who was trying to qualify the March at the time, had a hand in. I don't think he's ever really got over it, because he went one way and thought Gilles would go the other, and vice versa. It was just a terrible misunderstanding, and the result was a ghastly accident.
And one which has a certain parallel to Senna's crash, in that it robbed the sport of one of its real romantic heroes.
Totally agree.
Villeneuve wasn't a world champion, and he might never have become a world champion, but he gave every race an element of drama, and people really, really loved him for that. Really hardcore fans adored him for the drama he brought. He gave the impression that he didn't care about collecting points for a championship. That's not what he was doing. He just wanted to go out and beat everybody else in whatever race he was in that weekend. So there was an incredible sense of loss, probably the greatest since Jim Clark's death in 1968.
I think that's a good parallel. But before we move on to the other death that year, which we also want to talk about, personally, I think Villeneuve might well have won the world championship in 1982, had he lived, don't you?
It's possible. It's possible, up against his teammate, Pironi. Yep.
Well, yes, I think then, if one accepts that Villeneuve obviously had died, and therefore who would have won it after that? Well, I think Pironi, his Ferrari teammate, might have won it too, had he not then had that horrendous crash at Hockenheim, which didn't kill him, but did injure him so badly that he never raced in Formula One again. But anyway, that's by the by, because there was another death in 1982, and actually, Pironi was involved.
Yes, he was. A few weeks after Villeneuve's death, poor Riccardo Paletti, an Italian driver driving for Osella, crashed into the back of Pironi's Ferrari at the start in Montreal. Pironi had stalled on the grid, and there were no procedures in place to account for that, and Paletti just ploughed into the back of the stationary Ferrari at 110 miles an hour, and that was it for him.
Yeah.
And I suppose if Villeneuve's death was a bit like Senna's, Paletti's was a little bit like Ratzenberger's, in that it occurred to a lesser-known driver to the public at large, but it was no less shocking or saddening to people inside the sport.
It's a remarkable parallel in that sense, actually, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Very saddening. Mm. But as we've said, those were the last two driver deaths at World Championship Grand Prix heading into the 1990s. And they were two very distinct accidents. They weren't the fault of the circuits, that's for sure. They weren't particularly the fault of the available safety precautions either. One was a driver misjudgment, and the other was just bad luck. So I think Formula One felt at that point that if it hadn't rendered itself completely safe, then it was very much less dangerous than it had been.
I think you're right, actually, Richard. Yeah, they were accidents, obviously. Freak accidents, if you like. But then all accidents are freak accidents. You know, accidents happen because something has happened by accident that couldn't be planned for or is hard to plan for, which by its nature is a bit of a freak. Accidents are freaks. Hindsight, of course, is a wonderful thing. Looking back now, we might think, with hindsight, that something like Imola 1994 was always likely to happen. And I've already described Tamburello as an accident waiting to happen. And I think today that's probably still my view. I think we'd been pretty lucky through the mid and late 1980s and into the early 1990s. We'd been lucky that nothing really bad had happened. I know Elio De Angelis was killed in testing. I'm talking about at Grand Prix meetings. But Richard, did you feel that, watching at the time? I mean, I didn't start in Formula One going to Grand Prix as a journalist until the very early 90s, but you'd been doing so for some time already. Did you already have the sense that disaster might be just around the corner? Because my feeling was very much that Formula One had been riding its luck. You know, the cars had gradually been getting faster, and some of the circuits were not that much safer. And Grand Prix were therefore literally, as I say, to keep using this phrase, accidents waiting to happen. You know, we'd already seen Martin Donnelly's huge, horrible, grim crash at Jerez in 1990, and poor Philippe Strife's accident in Rio in 1989 that left him in a wheelchair. But what's your view?
Well, as with De Angelis, I think one of the reasons Strife came out of it so badly was that it was a testing accident and there weren't the facilities in place to treat him at the time. Yeah, so that was a bit of a wake-up call.
Yeah, good point.
But as you say, I've been following Formula One since the late 50s when I was a kid. So I'd got used to the idea of people dying, which sounds horrible, but it's true. As a fan, you just did. You knew it was a dangerous sport and the drivers were putting themselves at risk every time they went out. And on a Monday morning, you know, you might, your dad might hand you the Daily Telegraph and there'd be the news that Peter Collins had been killed at Nürburgring. You know, it wasn't a giant headline, but there it was. And, you know, you kind of got used to that. So to me, the lack of fatal accidents in the second half of the 80s was almost an anomaly in a way. Although, of course, it was fantastic to see drivers walking away from things that in earlier eras would have been fatal.
Yeah, I mean, to be clear, when I said I started in Formula One in the early 90s, I mean, I started as a journalist. I'd been following it, you know, for 20 years before then in the early 70s. But before that, you know, even minor offs led to deaths back in the day. I mean, let's take Luigi Musso. You know, he was fatally injured at Reims in 1958 when he ran just a little wide on one of the turns. Was it the Gur turn?
Yeah, it was just after the start. It was the right-hander, I think.
Yes, yes.
Soon after the start, a very high speed.
It's called Gur, isn't it?
Well, it's on the way to the village of Gur.
Yes, exactly. Anyway, he in his Ferrari, and he just dropped a wheel into a ditch. But what then happened is the car somersaulted, and that was that. And just imagine if that could happen today. Just imagine that if a, I mean, thank goodness it isn't the case, but it almost beggars belief to finish describing it. But just imagine if a driver could be killed today simply because, all on his own, not a collision, all on his own, he'd run just a little bit wide on one corner.
Yep, exactly. They died even in incidents like Musso's that sometimes look really quite innocuous.
Exactly so. Just running a little bit wide.
Yeah.
Anyway, as you say, you started watching Formula One in the late 50s. I started following Formula One in the early 70s, which, if I may say so, probably matches our age difference, if you don't mind my saying so. But anyway, in the early 1970s, it was no picnic. There were lots of deaths then, even after Jackie Stewart's safety campaign had begun to get going. And just as you were saying that your dad might have handed you the Daily Telegraph and you learned about Peter Collins' death, I have a specific memory of buying Motorsport magazine, the issue that had the 1977 South African Grand Prix report in it, written by Dennis Jenkinson. Now, not only did Tom Price die in that race, but also the marshal who he collided with ran over, just 19 years old, Frederick Jansen van Vuren, who was marshalling his very first Grand Prix. Terribly sad story, this. Who'd run across the track carrying a fire extinguisher to attend to Renzo Zorzi's car, which ironically was the shadow, Price's teammate, therefore, Price's shadow teammate. Just a tragic accident on every level. But my point I'm going to make is there was a three-page report in Motorsport magazine, dense copy, small pictures, and Jenks mentioned the death of Tom Price on page 3 of that report. Price wasn't even mentioned in the headline or stand first. The headline in stand first was all about Niki Lauda bouncing back to form because he hadn't won for a while. It defies belief nowadays. God forbid it should ever happen again, but could you imagine someone dying in a Grand Prix and it not being mentioned until page 3 of the race report?
Yeah, I don't think it would be right to give the impression that Dennis Jenkinson was a heartless man.
No,
I'm
not
saying
that.
I don't think he was a heartless man at all. I think he had a deep feeling. Well, I've been saying things about him too, about his way of reporting.
Yes.
But he was a man of his time. I think he had a deep feeling for motor racing and for racing drivers. But that's the way things were then. I mean, I remember in 1958, I mentioned Peter Collins dying. The Jenks' Motorsport report mentioned Collins' accident and death about three quarters of the way down the report.
It must again, have been,
not a headline. And he was in the running for the world championship,
yeah.
You know, unlike Price, you know, and a national figure. So that's extraordinary. But, you know, remember in the 50s, these were people who'd come through a world war and their parents had come through another one. And they had memories of huge death tolls. So I think death kind of didn't mean the same thing then to them that it would mean to us now. That may seem facile, but I think it's true.
I don't think it's facile. I think it's a good point. And I think there's certainly the case that that would have been the case with Jenks. But also, I think he might have also had the feeling that, you know, it might also have been somehow kind of ladling it on to harp on about the death, maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not here to comment. But anyway.
Sensationalist. What he didn't want to do was sensationalise
exactly.
motor racing.
Exactly.
And so he kind of under-sensationalised it, I guess.
Exactly. It was a different time and a different style of reporting and a different generation and a different attitude, as you rightly say. Nonetheless, it's emblematic of how things have changed and how they were then and aren't now. So we're talking about this danger, this danger wasn't removed as the 80s turned into the 90s, not really. It was more, for all these reasons we've just alluded to, some of which did include luck, hadn't had any deaths in that time. That's all in my view. But Tamburello, the scene of the terrible tragedy that befell Ayrton Senna, was a very dangerous corner. And as I mentioned earlier, perhaps Formula One's most dangerous, particularly when you look at some of the close escapes that had been there already.
Yeah, there had been a lot of close calls. In the second half of the 80s and the start of the 90s, there was a series of incredibly lurid crashes there from which four drivers were lucky to emerge. But in a way, that might have added to the complacency because there might have been a sense of, well, they survived those gigantic shunts, so the cars must be safe enough.
Yeah.
The first really big one was Nelson Piquet in 1987, which was a very, very violent crash that he managed to step out of. And then the second one, I remember particularly well, Gerhard Berger in a Ferrari in 1989, and it was caught on TV. He hit the wall hard and the car ran along the wall at Tamburello, came to a halt and caught fire. And when I say caught fire, it just exploded. The whole car was engulfed in flames in an instant. And you turned away and thought, he can't possibly get out of this.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't there. I was watching it at home on TV. And Murray Walker and James Hunt, who were doing the commentary, I remember the tone of their voices just changed instantly. Not just Murray's voice, by the way, but James's too. James's voice was heavy with foreboding. I think they both thought that they were commentating on images of Gerhard dying in the car.
Yes, it looked like it was going to be like Lorenzo Bandini, who died in a burning car at Monaco in 1967, and everybody saw it.
And heard it, his cries for help, my goodness. Look, I don't want to be too morbid, but that is the case.
But with Berger, a marshal's vehicle turned up quite quickly with a couple of guys with fire extinguishers, and they managed to put the fire out. And Gerhard got out with only burns to his hands and a few broken ribs, unbelievably. So I think that he missed just a single race after that. And you couldn't believe it. You thought, God, those flameproof overalls and balaclavas, they must be really good. They're really doing their job. It was an amazing thing.
Yeah, we've had a few of these crashes over the years where sometimes you're just staring in amazement at the screen. And by the way, even if you're at the race as a journalist, some people don't realise this, you're actually staring at the screen. You're not staring out of the window at the racetrack. You're in the press room staring at a screen and the data screens and the footage as well. But anyway, let's move on, because then there was Michele Alboreto, who crashed in a footwork, I think it was, in 1991, and his car also caught fire. And this was Tamburello, albeit not quite as spectacularly as Berger's had. And Alboreto had lost his front wing approaching the corner, which I have to say has eerie similarities to what happened to Roland Ratzenberger, as we'll come to on our next podcast.
Yep. And then there was Riccardo Patrese's crash in 1992, which I think was particularly nasty, actually, because Tamburello had this long curving wall on the outside of the turn following the curve of the river. But at the start of it, there was a little entrance, presumably for Marshall's vehicles to get in and out. And so there was an end to the wall. And Patrese, who was going at, 170 miles an hour, went in and hit the end of that wall. And that could have been the end of him. But it wasn't, thank goodness.
Yeah, thank goodness.
So there we mentioned four giant accidents, because there was no such thing as a small accident at Tamburello, thanks to the very high entry speed and the very solid and unprotected wall. And after what happened in 1994, some of these were cited as missed opportunities to do something about safety there.
Yeah. I mean, all four drivers we've just mentioned in those four big crashes could have been killed or seriously injured, and yet all raced on. But, you know, violent accidents and death have always been a part of motor racing history. Always a regrettable, horrible, terrible part of it, but a part of it nonetheless. And Richard, you know, I'm curious to know, do you think by this stage, with Formula One being broadcast live around the world, was our perception, or was the world's perception of acceptable risk changing? You know, we're here to reappraise the past. That's what Anne Colossally, That's History, aims to do. But if any of those accidents we mentioned happen now, would the reaction be different?
I think only when there are fatalities involved is the reaction extreme. I think actually people like accidents. You only have to look at the trailers for Drive to Survive. People like to see cars crashing into each other and flying through the air and debris going all over the place. Now, nobody goes to a motor race to see an accident or watches it on TV to see an accident. I really believe that's true. But if they see one, they say, wow. Particularly if no one's hurt. And it's memorable and thrilling and an indication of the challenge the drivers are overcoming. I also think public attitudes to the loss of life has changed. This is the thing that's changed a lot since the World Wars, when people were used to their nearest and dearest not coming back in very large numbers.
Yeah, I think it's a time thing in that sense. Wars, the two world wars, normalized death to normal people. But it's also a place thing as well as a time thing. I'll give you an example. I remember doing a story about the Indian motor industry in the early 1990s. And I went to Mumbai, to do it. And I remember opening the Times of India newspaper, great newspaper. And I remember opening it one morning and reading a headline, 57 killed in railway mishap. And I remember just, you know, even then, this is 30 years ago, staring at the headline thinking, a mishap. A mishap is when I drop my cup of tea on the floor, you know, not 57 dead. Can you imagine 57 dead in a railway accident in the UK being described as a mishap? Not then, and certainly not now, but yes, then in India. But there you are. Attitudes to death are different according to not only time, but also place.
But time is a very big thing. I mean, if you think back to 1961, when Wolfgang von Trips was killed at Monza in an accident that was live on television, he went off the track, killed himself, and killed 15 spectators.
Yeah.
And the race carried on completely. And it was not worldwide. Oh, no, it was a horror thing, but it was not worldwide headlines. So I think the passage of time is really the biggest factor.
I think it is a bigger factor. I'm just making the other point, but I do agree with you. So anyway, there we were. We're in the early 1990s. We had extremely fast cars, tracks that were safer than before, but still not especially safe. And while we hadn't seen a driver death in some time, we'd seen some very, very narrow escapes for drivers after some very, very big crashes. And then the FIA moved the goalposts for 1994, which was a crucial change. But we'll tell you more about that after this short break.
And At the end of part two, Matt mentioned that the FIA moved the goalposts for 1994, and what he was getting at is that the governing body made some major technical changes ahead of the season, banning all of the so-called driver aids, including traction control, ABS and active suspension, and at the same time introducing refuelling. One of these, banning the driver aids, was expected, as the FIA had wanted to return the driver to being more in control. But the refueling was unusual, wasn't it, Matt?
It was. I think the unspoken reason for introducing refueling was to add strategic variety to races as a response, really, to Williams' domination. It wasn't a safety thing, in other words, but it was unusual because it made the cars lighter, because they were carrying lower fuel loads, and therefore faster, because lighter cars are faster. And the FIA usually worked and works to curb speed increases, so that change actually increased the speeds. So banning driver aids and making the cars lighter at the same time had the effect of making the cars skittish and less controllable, but faster. And that's not really a great cocktail. And Williams, who'd signed Ayrton Senna from McLaren for 1994, were suffering more than most. Their car was tricksy. That 1994 was tricky to drive. And also, in-race refueling was in and of itself dangerous. You know, we all remember Jos Verstappen's famous pit lane fire at Hockenheim in 1994 and extraordinary images of the mechanic, Paul Seabee, his name, Paul Seabee, engulfed in flames, spectacularly photographed by my friend Stephen T.
Yeah, horrifying accident. It was
by the way, not hurt, by the way.
No, not
badly injured. I'll just say that. Go ahead.
But when it happened, it looked like the nightmare of nightmares.
It totally did.
A car going up in flames in the pits with all that fuel around and all those people closely packed. But somehow it was put out and Stephen T got his award-winning photograph.
He did indeed.
But Williams had been almost laughably dominant in 1992 and 93 with the cars produced by Patrick Head and Adrian Newey and Paddy Lowe, with all the gizmos, as they were known. Maybe you remember that Mansell won the first five races in 1992 and eight of the first nine.
Anorak facts.
Yeah, and people say Max Verstappen's boring. Yes. But obviously the FIA and other people were getting pretty bored themselves with that, not least Ayrton Senna. And Senna had done what he hadn't done in F1 to that point and joined Williams. Frank Williams had been the first person to give the young Senna a test in an F1 car, but Frank had commitments to other drivers, and Ayrton signed with Tolman for 1984 to begin his F1 career and then moved on to Lotus and then to McLaren. But by 1993, Williams was so superior and McLaren didn't have a works engine deal, so Senna began to do everything he possibly could to get a seat there for 1994. Matt, do you remember at Donington in 1993 when Ayrton won in the wet?
Well, I do. If you were there, you were wet.
You were. And I was there and wet. And I'll never forget the post-race press conference when Ayrton had won with that magic first lap where he went from fifth to first.
Unbelievable.
The most YouTube replayed lap in F1 history, I'm sure.
Fifth to first in 70 seconds.
Yep. Including Alain Prost. And Prost had ended up coming third. And at the press conference, he was sitting there complaining that he'd had to change tyres five times and the car was doing this and the car was doing that. I had some slow pit stops and the brakes didn't work and the ashtray was full. And Ayrton leaned into the microphone across to him and said, "I'll swap cars with you whenever you like."
Yeah, perfect repartee there. And, of course, he absolutely coveted the Renault V10 in Prost's Williams, because he had, you know, comparatively humdrum Ford V8.
He did, but by the time he got the engine he wanted, the Renault, the sad thing was that the rules had changed, and Williams, who'd built their great championship cars around those amazing gizmos, not very surprisingly, at the beginning there was trouble. The 1994 car, without the gizmos, didn't handle very well. Although, having said that, Ayrton took that very unsatisfactory car, and in the first race of the 1994 season, he stuck it on pole.
He did. And, you know, I tell you, he only entered three races in 1994 for obvious and tragic reasons, but he put it on the pole in all three.
That was a lot more to do with him than the car, that's for sure.
Well, it was. And, you know, Damon Hill was his teammate. And, you know, Damon Hill, no mean driver, no mean qualifier. But Ayrton, you know, let's just record this. It's a fact. Ayrton was more than a second quicker than Damon in qualifying at Interlagos and 6/10 quicker than Damon in qualifying for both the next two races. You know, Ayrton Senna, car problems or not, drove absolutely beautifully in that Williams until the tragedy of Imola.
Of course, he had the confidence of being Ayrton Senna and having three championships and 41 wins behind him, which Damon didn't have. But what he did to get those three poles was quite extraordinary because, you know, it was obvious that it was a very difficult car. And I remember I was there at that first race of the season in Interlagos. And in the race, he spun off at a place where you would never imagine he'd spin, and he had to retire. And you thought, what? Why? How?
Yeah.
It was something awkward in the car's handling at that time, a problem that he'd been having to drive around. And so Michael Schumacher and his Benetton went on to win that race.
Indeed, he did. And also, while we're talking about safety, which we are, in that Brazil race, we saw another very close escape and a reminder of how exposed the drivers were in those days when Martin Brundle's head was struck during, you know, in the middle of a multi-car shunt. And that followed huge crashes in testing for both Jean Alesi and JJ Leto, who were both forced to miss races because of damaged vertebrae. And then we went on to AIDA, the AIDA circuit in Japan, the Pacific Grand Prix for round two. And Senna, under pressure after his poor start at home in Brazil, you know, and still struggling massively with the handling of his tricky, difficult Williams, took pole position again.
Yeah, he does. But then at the start, he's taken out of the race in a multi-car tangle triggered by McLaren's Mika Hakkinen and also involving Nicola Larini, Alesi's replacement at Ferrari. And then we get this great TV shot of Senna standing at the trackside, watching and listening to the two Benettons. Senna was someone who did a lot of watching and listening. He was a very reflective, analytical character. And he wasn't just waiting for the race to play out or for someone to take him back to the pits. He was standing there thinking. And what he was doing, listening to the Benettons, was trying to work out why Schumacher was so quick. He realised that Schumacher's car seemed to have something that Jos Verstappen's, his teammates, didn't. And the conclusion he came to was that it was using illegal traction control, the sort of device that had been outlawed from the beginning of the season.
Yeah, and the key word you used there, Richard, is listening. Because from that point on, and indeed over the next few years, there was a lot of listening going on. Photographers would come back from trackside after a session and tell us in the paddock, that Benetton or that Ferrari sounds like it has traction control. They might have been right, they might have been wrong. But in 1994, there were a lot of people who thought, and certainly Senna was one of them, that what they were listening to was indeed illegal traction control. He was convinced of it. He was absolutely convinced of it. You know, and I'm not saying he was right, but he was totally convinced of it. And, you know, as you say, he was a very intelligent, very analytical, and a very intense person. And he was strategic and deliberate. Nothing Ayrton Senna ever really did was by mistake. And I think he had a very firm moral and indeed religious code on top of all that. And I think all those things came together to make him feel strongly that he was being wronged, personally wronged. And the sport was also being wronged, and that he was being made to compete in a legal car against an illegal car. And it became, I'm not going to say a crusade, I'm not saying that he was right, but it was an obsession.
Yeah. And that sense of injustice was a big characteristic of his throughout his career. We saw it throughout his career. If you remember in the 80s, when he was having his battles with Prost, he thought that Jean-Marie Balestre, the president of the FIA, and like Prost, a Frenchman, was taking Prost's side.
Well, he probably was.
Yep. that may very well be true. It might have been justified. But he felt he was someone who'd come from Brazil to Europe to a sport that was basically European, and that now the odds were being stacked against him. And that's what lay behind those famous collisions with Prost at Suzuka, that sense of injustice and feeling that he had to do something about it. And whatever you think about that, whether he was right or wrong. And with Schumacher's Benetton in 1994, I think he began to get the same kind of feeling, that something was going against him in an unfair way.
And Totally.
Yeah, and we know, because we know now, that the traction control and launch control programs were left in the Benetton car, if you knew how to activate them with the right combination of buttons. Of course, the Benetton team said, well, no, we weren't using them. We left them on because they were too hard to take off, but we didn't use them. Well, Senna, standing there listening, felt that something was going on.
Certainly he did. And I'm not about to libel the Benetton team by saying it was definitely illegal activity. I mean, I don't have the facts. We don't have the facts. But a lot of people felt, fans, journalists, other teams, that the fact that Option 13, as it was called, was left in the system and hadn't been wiped was iffy. Let's just call it iffy. But the Benetton team said they never deployed it. And probably if Pat Simmons is listening to this, he'll be jumping up and down and raging, perhaps not raging, but perhaps not jumping up and down, but objecting quietly and saying all this is completely untrue. Well, we're not saying that they definitely did something illegal. What we're saying is that the atmosphere at the time included a lot of people who felt that they were. And it was left in the system, option 13, and apparently never deployed. But I think it's fair to say that a lot of people found that rather hard to believe.
Yeah, hard to believe. And I did talk to someone once after all this who really knows about that stuff from the inside. And he said that, honestly, it would be the work of a moment or not much more to take that software out of the car so that there'd be no question of using it. But that wasn't done. It was still there.
Indeed so. And key to our narrative, whether or not it was ever deployed, but key to our narrative as we look towards and forwards towards that fateful Imola weekend is that Ayrton was absolutely convinced it was being used. And let's not forget, Ayrton had had one of his best ever seasons in 1993, 5 victories in a McLaren MP4-8, powered by a Ford V8, and I've called it already comparatively humdrum, shouldn't really have been able to win 5 Grand Prix, but it did. It wasn't the equal of the Williams, nowhere near. So as we went into 1994, I think a lot of people felt, me included, that Williams had already been dominant, but Williams plus Senna was going to be a combination unbeatable, and that it was going to sweep all before it. And yet the season started not only with him not winning either of the first 2 races, but also this feeling of it's all going against me. And this move to Williams is not working out. Furrowed brows all round at Williams, and the most furrowed of all, Ayrton Senna's.
Yeah, I remember very clearly interviewing Michael Schumacher at the beginning of that season, when it was obvious that he was the coming man, but he wasn't expected to beat Senna, or not yet, or at least not regularly. The interview happened, Benetton were testing at Silverstone with Michael and Jos Verstappen. And I remember asking Michael about his prospects for the season and saying, you know, saying to him, Senna's at Williams, do you really think you stand a chance? And I remember his words exactly. He said, yep. By strategies and stuff, I think we might be in with a chance. And as the season went on, I kept wondering, what was that and stuff? What did he mean by that? I should have asked him, really.
Well, I think that phrase, I mean, the words and stuff were doing a lot of heavy lifting, weren't they?
They were indeed.
Well, I remember at that time I was working for Car Magazine, the Road Car Magazine, not necessarily the most imaginatively titled magazine in the world, since it was a car magazine called Car Magazine. But we sent an Italian photographer, Dario Mitidieri, his name, to Imola in 94 by chance, because of course we didn't know that anything unusual was going to happen. But we sent him to do some beautiful black and white arty stills photography in the Williams garage. And as I say, we didn't know what was going to end up happening. And then we certainly didn't know that it was going to end up being one of the most tragic and dramatic weekends in Formula 1 history. Dario was just there to do a fly-on-the-wall art shoot. But when we got the pictures back, some of the photographs, when we looked at them, I mean, well, talk about furrowed brows. Beautiful photography. Mitty Dieri was a great photographer. But looking at Ayrton, you could just see that human frailty in the raw. You could see that he was just unhappy, haunted, bewitched almost.
And constantly in very intense discussions with the engineers at Williams in the garage. That was very noticeable. And there was another photographer, John Nicholson, who was there. He was there basically because he was Damon Hill's mate. And he was there, as well as a very good photographer.
Indeed.
And he was there in the pits taking photos. And he took similar shots to Dario Mitidieri's. And they both showed that there was a kind of heavy mood there that weekend, something that was building up in the Williams garage.
Yeah, definitely there was a mood, you know, an uncomfortable feeling, certainly.
Yeah, indeed.
So there we are. We have Senna struggling to adapt to his new environment, struggling with a tricky car, struggling in the point standings too. And he'd become highly suspicious of what Benetton, who'd won the first two races with Michael Schumacher, were doing. And he was now desperate to score that first win of the season at Imola. And that's where I think we'll pick things up next time.
Thank you so much for joining us for this episode. As Matt says, on the next one, we'll be chronologically dissecting all the events of that terrible weekend at Imola in 1994.
Yeah, so be sure to follow or subscribe to the feed to make sure you don't miss out on that or any other of our episodes.
A big thank you to all of you who sent us such lovely feedback on the podcast or indeed left us glowing reviews online. We read all of your messages and we love hearing from you.
We do indeed. We're very grateful for them and we do our best to justify your very kind comments. And if you want to get in touch with us and make comments, kind or unkind, preferably kind, you can do so. You can drop us a line on podcasts@the-race.com. Or you can drop Richard or me a message on Twitter or X. I'm at TheBishF1 and Richard is at RWilliams1947.
So until next time, it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him.
And colossally, that's history.
The Athletic.